Right, today is the fourth in our series of the 13 principles of faith, and today we're looking at the 10th and 11th principle of the Rambam. So I'll read you the two principles, and then we'll discuss them. They do go together. The 10th principle is, I believe with perfect faith that God knows all of man's deeds and thoughts. It is thus written, he has molded every heart together, he understands what each one does. So God's omniscience, God knows everything. Right, so he knows every thought, every deed, every action that we have. We'll talk about that in a minute. And the 11th one is, I believe with perfect faith that God rewards those who keep his commandments and punishes those who transgress his commandments. So reward and punishment and all-knowingness. Those are the two ones. So 10 is all-knowingness and 11 is reward and punishment. Before I start all this, I just want to say that our learning should be in the merit of my granddaughter who is struggling for her life, unfortunately. And hopefully we'll get to struggle for a long time, but it's touch and go every minute. So her name is Rivka Chaya Bat Elisheva Chana, twins, right? So she's the younger of the two, but she has a rare condition that I haven't had a lot of success with, and there's no scientific literature on, so because it's pretty rare. Anyway, so she should be healed. So I thought about not coming today because we just don't know, you know, minute to minute. I spent Shabbos in the hospital. I'll tell you one magic cholent story. You know, cholent is a magic food. I don't know if you're aware of that. Cholent is food that you serve on Shabbos. We're supposed to have a hot food on Shabbos that we didn't cook on Shabbos, that we keep hot the whole night in order to say that we agree that the oral law is true and real. Because the written law says no fire on Shabbos. So if we were literalists and just went with the written law, we would not have hot food on Saturday because no fire on Shabbos. But the oral law says no kindling fire on Shabbos, but you could have it the whole time if you kindle it before. So for that reason, we specifically eat something hot on the Sabbath day, not the night, that had to be kept hot the whole time. So cholent in the Ashkenazic world, cholent is that food. But it's a magic food. Besides the fact that it's an oral law affirmation food, there's always enough. Always. So we had different people cooking for my kids in the hospital. They're staying in the hospital. They got a boarding room so they could stay there. And then right before Shabbos, we were thinking, oh, maybe we should transfer her to children. She's in such critical condition. Maybe we need the best place, the best. Like, how can we push her? And we asked all kinds of questions. Yes, we can break the Sabbath in order to bring her to the best facility. What will happen? So maybe my husband will go with the father and take that baby, and I'll stay with the mom and stay with the other baby, you know, and we'll divide up all the food. But meanwhile, the community's cooked the food for this couple. And as I'm taking the food from the Rebbetzin for Friday night, it's so much food. I'm like, it's two people in the hospital. How much food do they need? A whole potato kugel and three pieces of chicken and four baked apples and two acorn squashes full of soup and somebody else is bringing lunch. And they brought a cholent, right? So I'm bringing all this food to the hospital. I'm like, this is ridiculous. So much food. Meanwhile, it turns out now there's four of us in the hospital, plus the fifth showed up right before candlelighting and said, I'm here to spend Shabbos with you. So there are five of us instead of two of us. And the cholent went far enough for all five, plus somebody then walked in to visit an hour and a half. And there was enough cholent just left over for a bowl for him after he got there. Like, there's always enough cholent. It's amazing. So anyway, So I wasn't sure if I should do this class, and then I thought, well, you know what? Speaking about how God knows everything and reward and punishment is an important thing to think about in a case like this. There's a lot of times when people think about, like, why is... You know, my daughter's married to a quadriplegic, so she's thinking to herself, like, haven't we had enough? Isn't it enough? Like, why do we have to deal with this too? We waited 4.5 years to conceive. Now we conceived. Now we have twins, and now one of them might not make it. You know, so in addition to might not make it, she's like, you know, you're back and forth. Like, maybe she will, and there's the hope. And then, of course, we have to think maybe she won't, and then what it's going to be like if she won't. Do you get to sit Shiva? Don't you sit Shiva? What's all the pity going to be like, and how will I have to deal with it? You don't sit Shiva before a month. You do sit Shiva after a month. You know, and there's all that, like, all those feelings inside. You can't help but not think ahead, like, what will happen, and yet you want to stay in where you are in the hope, but it's so, like, back and forth. And then you're happy with the one baby who's healthy and looking through the window at the other baby who's hooked up to a million things and constantly in crisis. So, and then wondering, like, in the crisis when the oxygen drops, like, if she will make it, what will she be like? You know, there's, like, all those feelings back and forth. Like, it's really a lot. So if anybody wants to daven for her, Rivka Chaya Bat Elisheva Chana, she needs lots of prayers. That being said, though, it's so these I think it's important to think about reward and punishment. Now, it's interesting because I have a grandson from a different child who has Down syndrome. And when he was first born, so we got a whole video of processing of different from women and how they processed their child's significant disability, whether it was Down's, whether it was another kind of defect, whatever it was, how they processed it and how they shared it with family. And what was fascinating for me was, as somebody who wasn't born into an observant Jewish family, the amount of guilt and that was experienced, these were all from women, the amount of guilt, but also what I never thought of was for many of these women, they really saw their disabled child as like a red letter A on their chest. They saw it as punishment. Like one of them particularly said, you know, I kept praying and praying, please God forgive me, whatever I did to deserve this, please forgive me. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, that's how you feel. You like, now it gave me great insight into understanding why so many people, let's say from Hasidic families or very strong families, would give up a Down's child at birth, not just because it might hurt the shidduch possibilities, the matching possibilities of their other children, but because they would see, I never thought about it, them as seeing it as wearing their sins on their sleeve. That's not my understanding, which we will talk about in this class. But some people, I think, misunderstand and think that reward and punishment is that sharp and that keen that if you're the parent of a severely disabled child, that it's because it's your fault, you deserve it, and you're being punished, and everybody can see how bad you are because of the fact that you have this child. So there are people who feel that way. It's an incorrect understanding. But nevertheless, incorrect understandings are maintained within us. There are many things that Jews think that aren't Jewish thoughts. So that's why we want to look at this a little bit today. So what does it mean that God knows everything? And what does it mean that God rewards and punishes? So reward and punishment is a very difficult concept that a lot of people really don't appreciate. Really don't like. I mean, appreciate that way, but really don't appreciate in also meaning not just dislike, but don't get what it means. So if we talk about reward and punishment, we can think about, and thinking about our own selves as parents, why we reward and punish. And so first we can think narrowly. We reward and punish because we're happy with behavior or unhappy with behavior, or because we're trying to shape behavior, right? So it could be conditioning, right? Reward and punishment for conditioning. I don't know if anybody watches the IT crowd. Is it not the IT crowd? That's the British one. Big Bang Theory. So on the Big Bang Theory, I have kids. We don't have a TV, but I have kids who watch internet shows. Anyway, so there's a whole thing about conditioning. Somebody was sitting too close to somebody, he had a spray bottle, he tried it like a dog, right? Every time she did something didn't like, he sprayed her with water. Every time he did something she did like, he offered her a chocolate. And eventually, she was doing what he liked, right? So we do reward and punishment. We do reward and punish for conditioning's sake. But we as human beings also reward and punish because of our own processing, right? I mean, there are times when we inappropriately punish a child, right? Hit them, yell at them, take away privilege because we're upset, not because it's the best thing for them, not because it's going to guide them. I mean, if we think about ourselves as educators and think it is my job, one of my parenting mantras, which thank God I'm past this stage, but I used to really work with this, was educate, don't berate. It's just a phrase I tried to keep in my head. Like, I'm in this situation, my job is to educate, not berate. Right? Because it's very easy to say, I can't believe you did whatever again, blah, 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 right? So, right? Rather than just saying, when you put the cup at the edge of the table, it's more likely to spill. Educate, don't berate, right? You just want to educate. My job is to educate you, not to berate you, because I want to create the right environment. It was a really helpful mantra for me. Another one was, they will grow up, they will grow up. Which actually I did say regularly, and it helped, because just have to see like a little further down the tunnel, you know. I told my husband like about a year or two ago, my youngest is 18 now, I said, I feel like I see a light at the end of the tunnel. And he said, oh honey, he said, that's an oncoming train. So, nevertheless, that's one reason why we reward and punish, right? So we reward and punish for conditioning, and really conditioning is the main reason we should be rewarding and punishing. as parents. But because we know that we do it out of anger, then when we hear about reward and punishment and we know that we have a relationship with our Father in heaven, we can think about anger. And we can think about being slapped for anger rather than for conditioning or rather than for correcting our path, right? So it's not always conditioning. As a child gets more sophisticated and they take the car out, whatever, and they get into an accident, they were careless, whatever. So it's not necessarily conditioning to say you need to pay for it, but it is it's awareness raising and teaching them how to be conscious of things and be responsible and set goals and take responsibility for what they did, right? So it is part of educating them, not berating. You don't have to be all over them about how careless they were, but they made a mistake and they need to rent you a car that you can drive and they need to pay for the mistake and they need to take the car in and inconvenience themselves instead of you in order to fix it. Like, take responsibility. And this is how you educate them. And it is a punishment, but it's not a punishment. You're not doing it to punish. You're doing it to facilitate your life, but you're doing it also to help them understand, yes, there's consequences when you don't check behind you and there's a tree, you know, or whatever it is. Things happen, and it costs, and now you need to pay the price, not me. So, but even that is different than the reason why God rewards and punishes, because God doesn't say you need to pay the price instead of me, right? It's a whole different thing, but there is a responsiveness. We understand that the whole purpose of creation, the whole reason that we're here, is to grow our soul. I think we talked about that before, but the whole purpose is to transform the soul that we were given into something else. And the only way that we can transform our soul is by using the physical tools that we have. Souls can't transform themselves. They have to be placed into an environment where they have a tool. So where they have a body, they're slipped into a body that the body can act on things. Soul can't act on things, but can cause the body to act on things. And then placed in a whole physical arena in which it can be presented with choices and circumstances to act through. So the whole purpose is to use this world to grow our souls. That's it. But it's use this world to grow our souls for what? To be in relationship with God. So it's all about relationship. So God knowing everything and God responding to everything. That's what reward and punishment is, response. So God knows it all and God responds to it all. That's what's vital to understand, those twin concepts, for there to be a relationship. It could be, and some sages say, that it's similar to a computer program. That everything is, you know, if anybody ever took... I'm just looking at the crowd. You probably didn't take SATs online, but you might have taken GREs, not online, but with a computer. So you answer one question, and then the next question that's presented to you is based on the answer from the last question, right? So there's a possibility. Answer it right, you get this one. Answer it wrong, you get that one. And the whole test is built that way. It's not like a paper test, like in the olden days, where it's the same question. Question three is the same, no matter how you answer question two. But it's built on that. So, and the same thing with computer games, which I don't play, but just as an understanding, the whole game is built so that no matter what you choose, there is a response to your choice already built in. Right? It's not creating it, as far as I understand. Maybe we're up to that, but it's basically been programmed in. So there are those who hold that the world was created like that, that there are programmed responses to our choices. But that's actually difficult to understand with free will in the picture. So I was thinking, what can we use to see how this works? So let's just take teeth for a minute, okay? You brush your teeth, they stay healthy. You don't brush them, they get cavities, right? Is that a punishment, cavities? Or is that natural consequences? Okay, so let's call it natural consequences. But it is a punishment in a way. I mean, you have to go get your teeth filled. So not only do you have to have the sound, which is unpleasant, and take the time out of your schedule, which is unpleasant, you have to pay, which is unpleasant, right? And it doesn't always work, which is extra unpleasant, right? So, but if you brush your teeth carefully, you probably won't have to experience that. Now, I say probably, because everybody's different. What people eat is different, which provides a different mouth environment. How what people's genetics are different, which some people don't get cavities at all. You know, I'm not one of them, and I have children with Swiss cheese for teeth. You know, like, they have, I don't know how many tens of thousands of dollars we've spent on filling holes, but a lot, a lot. And how many times I've, you know, lied underneath a child at the dentist, you know, just holding them. Like, I'm in the chair, and my legs are wrapped around them, and I'm hugging them like this while they're getting their teeth filled. So, and even with that, I could fall asleep as a young mother because I was so sleep-deprived. Like, put me lying down, I'm out. Forget it. So is that reward or punishment? So there are natural consequences. However, there's a lot of factors that come into it too. So there is a response to how we behave, but there's also a programming. So those two kind of work together. So you could see that sort of, that there is a biological, there is a response. Don't take care of your teeth. And there's a great sign in one of my dentist offices, ignore your teeth, they'll go away. Right? So, yeah. Right. So that's what I want to say here is that while we might be able to say that there's math, don't brush your teeth, you do get cavities, we can see clearly because of all the various factors that it's not the same for everybody. Some people need to brush their teeth 3 times a day and they'll still have a little bit of cavities. Some people can get away with once a day or less and their teeth are fine.
So
there's varying circumstances. So that's a parable. That's a parable. So the parable is that there's varying circumstances. So that there is cause and response and varying circumstances. So in our lives, there is some cause and response and there's varying circumstances. One of the circumstances that is very varying is our relationship with God. So if we think about us in response to our children, think about your easier child and think about your more difficult child. And if you don't have tooth, so think about somebody else's easy kid and difficult kid, right? So easy kid could do something pretty egregious, but they're the easy kid, and really, you'll take it in stride. And difficult kid, all they have to do is one little thing, and you're yelling at them again because they're difficult kid, and they need to be yelled at all the time, right? There's just not a break for that kid. I have a child like that, and he was 5. He took a pair of fingernail scissors and cut apart a quilt that my great-great-grandmother crocheted. Okay, so it's on the bed. He's cut a big hole with it. Okay, so now he is 5. He knows cutting a hole in a bedspread is wrong. So I yelled at him to that level. You caused destruction. You knew what you were doing. You were wrong. But I realized I couldn't yell at him with the full force of my disappointment because he didn't know what he destroyed, right? So I had to hold back that level of, I can't believe you destroyed something that I got from generations back and now you've destroyed it. You know, like, how could you do that? Right? Because he doesn't know that, so it wouldn't be fair. However, I had held that back. It was still there. So it kept sneaking out in different places. So like the next day when I was yelling at him again about something, I started re-yelling at him about the same thing, I said, do you understand why I'm yelling at you? And he said, yes, because you always yell at me. I said, that's right. So that was my difficult child, and he got yelled at a lot because he always was pushing something that just went into the yelling. Right? So if another child would have done it, I could have explained it and not been so upset, but that child like always was always ready to be yelled at. So relationship makes a difference. That's the point. So we can be in different relationships with God. Why do you think we go to a tzaddik to get a blessing? Right? So right now, my daughter has put out the call in Israel, please, who can go visit various different rabbis? Who will go to different graves in Daven? Who will go to different tzaddikim and get blessings? Why do we want a blessing from a tzaddik? Why not a blessing from any one of us? Every Jew can give a blessing. But the tzaddik is the good child, right? And we, the one who's in favor with God, the one who's really worked on a relationship where they're in favor. And when the in favor child asks for the things, you know, if the easy kid says, can we have popsicles, referring to the difficult child, no problem, you give them both, right? But if it's the difficult child that comes in and says, we want popsicles right before dinner, you're like, I don't think so. You know, that's going to spoil your appetite. So it's very different who's asking, not necessarily what the request is. So relationship. So we have to understand that the whole point of soul transformation is to be in a greater relationship with God. If God didn't respond, if God didn't know, and God didn't respond, if it was just automatic, there's no relationship there. You know, so I was thinking about, yeah.
I don't know if I'm way off on what you're saying, but it almost sounds like there's a predetermined pathway that you're on, and you
Okay. Good. Yes, so that's the thing. So rather than, right, so let's go there for a second. Let me just finish a thought and then we'll go right there. So in terms of relationship, right, I don't know if anybody remembers those when we first got cell phones, or not even first, but let's say, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. You had these, there were cell phone pets, like a dog on a cell phone that you had to feed and you had to walk. Sometimes on the walk you'd find some money and then you could use that money to buy food for the dog. But if you didn't walk it often enough, you didn't get enough money, you couldn't buy enough food and the dog would die. Or if you didn't turn on your phone often enough and take care of it, it would die. Right? That's all predetermined. But there's no relationship with that dog, really. You still feel bad, and actually there were even incidences of car accidents because people were feeding their dog while they were driving because they knew the dog would die if they didn't take care of it, right? So, but this is a dog where there's no relationship at all. It's electronic, you know, and I think about when I walk into the house, the dogs come over and greet me. What if I'm wearing a black skirt? I don't want them all over me, you know? So I just push them away. I try to ignore them, and I think to myself a little guilty, that's not nice. They came to greet me. Like, I should just ignore them. I was gone the whole day. They were waiting for me to come home, and they came over, like, with happy faces. I should just ignore them? It's not, like, there's a relationship there, and I'm responsible to invest in it, especially if I want them to come over and greet me with happy faces when I am not wearing a black skirt. So... I could. Right. Well, I have one. I have a spray bottle that I put on the corner of the table when I'm frustrated with one of them who will not let me read the paper in the morning. He's all over me. You know, he's like, I'm sitting like this, and he puts his nose under here, like, constantly trying to get me to pet him. So so that's when I put the spray bottle on the corner, and he knows to run away. I don't have to even aim it at him. Just put it there. Right. So there's the conditioning. Okay. So what's up with that? So that's no relationship. Here we have a relationship. So now what's with the relationship? God does want us to be in a greater relationship. And that is what I explained to my daughter, who has a very strong level of faith and a very strong relationship with God. Why me? She didn't quite ask it that way, but that was the basis of the question. Why me? Don't we have enough in our life? And in fact, no. If you understand that the whole point is to grow. So a college student who just aced a chemistry test, and when the graduate department comes to her and says, we really want you in our graduate department, she's not going to say, why me? I just did so well on this test. You want me to learn more? You want me to put more effort into more chemistry? And the PhD department comes and says, actually, we really see a lot of potential in you, and we want you to be one of the top scientists in the country. Well, in order to be a top scientist in the country, you have to work really hard. And as soon as you master one thing, you're up to the next. And you have to work really hard to master that. So, but the more you master and the more work you put into it, and of course the more frustration that there is, the more reward that there is, the more you understand, the more you're open to being able to understand, the more you know you don't know, but the more you know, right? There's all that all mixed together. So that's what's really going on here. Yes, you're willing to step into something and work hard and grow. You're willing to choose to marry somebody who's that compromised but is fabulous and you want that relationship. That doesn't mean that you picked all the hard stuff in your life. That means God says, great, you're doing great. Come, take another step. Step forward, and I want you to grow more. Right? So you have to step into it again and again. And sometimes if you don't choose to accept the invitation the way that I see it now, having gone through many challenging children, that particular child that I yelled at a lot. My father once came to visit, and he did not come to visit often. It's like once in 5 years. But he came one time, and he saw this kid, and he was like, what is up with this child? I'm like, clearly that kid was really difficult. And I had spoken to Maya Rebitson about it, and I said, you know, this kid is so hard. She's like, it's a test. I'm like, okay, it's a test. So my father says, what's up with this child? And I say, it's a test. And he says, what do you get if you pass the test? I'm like, I don't know. So I go back to the rabbit, and I'm like, what do I get if I pass the test? So that was before I really understood the nature of tests. So there's no passing tests. We are tested. It's not about passing them. They're not pass-fail. They are workshops for continued growth. That's what they are. That's what they are. And they are offerings for continued growth. Now, sometimes God offers you a workshop and you say, no, thank you. And God says, yes, you will. And he gives you a little push from behind. And you're in a free fall for a little while in a workshop you'd really rather not take part in. But he knows best. And he does say, you are capable of this. And I want to cause you to grow way past where you would have gone on your own. So I'm going to give you this push into this unknown territory. And what do you get when you pass the test? You get a new you. On the other side is a new you. Whatever new you, you can create. Just like, and I think school is a great parable for this, just like you get when you graduate. Are you different at 18 than 22? Yes, you are, because you've pushed yourself. Now you're only as different as you've pushed yourself. You could go to a school and it's a party school and you just like slip by and you spend your time drinking and you're worse than you were when you went in. You're less motivated and you're less capable and you're 22 and you're job free and job potential free. Or, right, you know, they say that the science majors, the engineering majors say, how does this work? And philosophy majors say, why does this work? And liberal arts may just say, would you like fries with that? Anyway, so if you push yourself hard, and if you, and the harder you push yourself, if you're recognized and pushed by some professors or pulled forward or parents are pushing you or parents are pulling you, whatever it is, and you're pulling yourself and you're in an environment with smart kids and you want to be smart and it's cool to be smart and all that stuff, you could be amazingly different at the end of 4 years, at the end of however long it takes to get a PhD. I have kids on that track, so we'll see.
But I feel like that's so different than like the loss of a life or a person who's struggling with their life.
Mm-hmm.
Like so, a family that's having to deal with that, whether it's with a baby, with a parent.
But the question is, how do you grow through this?
So, I think that your example of a chemist, you know,
it's an easy example to see, right?
You know, to them, okay, so maybe they have some familiars, but we're not talking life and death.
No, we're not. So,
to help you grow.
Right, so let's just think about last week when we learned about Yaakov lying. Yaakov lying to Yitzchak, right? So there's lots of questions about it. How could Yaakov, the pillar of truth, have to lie to get the blessing? Right? So that was a conversation. How is that fair? How is that true? Like, how does that work? So it turns out all the tests of our forefathers were about stretch yourself. You think you're all about truth? Let's see how lying works for you in order to accomplish what you need to accomplish. You think you're a man of chesed, Abraham? Let's see how sacrificing your son on the altar works for you. Can you push yourself that far? You know, you think you're a man of boundaries, so let's see how that works for you, being bound on the altar. You know, like there's all places where God says, okay, you are this, great for you, now try being this. Right? It's all about how could you be more? Because what we want to do is transform ourselves. So we're born in this world a certain way. Some people are calm. Some people are quick to anger. Some people are very generous. The very generous person who also is very blessed and makes a lot of money, great for them that they give a lot of tzedakah. It's great, and they should. But the person who struggles to earn money and struggles to be generous and manages to write out a $36 check to somebody in the sandy path, you know, it could be a much bigger accomplishment for them than it is for the person who writes out the $3,600 check, depending on where they are and how much they had to push themselves. So it's all in the end about how do we grow through this. So that's why I talk about it as loving workshops that Hashem arranges for us. Hashem knows us best. He knows everything that we're thinking. He knows what we can do and what's hard for us. And with all that knowledge, that's the 10th principle, God knows us. With that, He can then custom design responses for us that will help us get further. So, and sometimes sometimes there is such a thing as punishment, which is usually re-pushing you back towards the path, which you get to pick if you choose to move back in the right direction or not. That's up to you every time, right? You still have free will. But you only have free will how to respond to, not what situation you're in. You don't have free will if you have a sick baby or not. But you do have free will, how do you respond to it?
I think that's a really cool thing. I'm sorry, I'm internalizing this a lot, because I just got my best answer, and my first response. I can't really help you. I need help you. Do everything right. That's not fair. And then, but I also ask, what's the greater purpose? What am I supposed to walk away with? But I think that if you're not in tune or asking yourself, what am I supposed to take away, then you'll never take anything.
Right. So then there's for you, and then in terms of the way God arranges the world, there's for your children, and for your parents, and for your neighbors, and for your fellow congregants, and for your husband. It's not just you. Right? You have to figure out what you're going to take away. And each one of them and all those layers out, you know, so there are some people who are really concerned about this baby, right? And some people, and then some, you guys, most of you don't know her, but still there's something that happens and you're supposed to feel that. Whatever that level is, she needs to be sick for you to feel that, right? And then when you talk to somebody else about this and say, oh, I just saw, had a teacher today whose baby is really struggling, they feel it much less. Right? But they still need to feel that, right? And so it's a broad net that God casts over the world, and all the influences are all calculated perfectly. Who has to experience what, and what we should take out of each thing?
Does the thought stem, though, that obviously no one wants the baby to be sick, but that the baby is sick for the reason of the growth, or now the baby's sick, how can we grow?
Both. Both. Yeah, it's really both. So it's the person in the moment has to think, how can I grow through this? How can I deal with this first? Which doctors do I find? Which hospital is best? What insurance is paying? All that stuff. How can I deal with this? And then how can I grow through this? You have to have both, right? So both of those thoughts. But then when you're looking, certainly in a class like this, when you're looking at it from the broader perspective, so you ask why, right? What is the point? So it's interesting to think about. I read a nice piece of Torah from Rabbi Gavriel Goldfeder in Boulder. So he talks about, why did our patriarchs often meet their wives at a well? What's this about wells and meeting women at wells? So I said, part of the relationship, and think about Rivka, right? When she went to the well, what happened? The water rose up. So what is a well? A well is where you bore down deep to get what you want. You send the bucket down to get it, and you draw it up. But Rivka was somebody that the water came to meet. So that a good spouse is somebody that can draw out of the depths of you, right, what you need to have drawn up. So that's part of the partnership, is being able to see the good that's deep down inside and have it come up. So if you think about Rivka's ability to have the water actually come to meet her, that was one, if you think about that as a parable, right? So that is one of the reasons why Eliezer saw, oh my gosh, look at this girl. Not only does she know how to go for what's good, but the good rises to meet her. She's able to call it up. So there are people in our lives that are there to call up goodness. So you might ask, why does somebody have to be in a wheelchair? What's up with that? You know, somebody who's hiking and takes kids on wilderness trips and is learning Torah, like why does he need to be there? But part of it is to draw out the goodness in others. Why does there need to be a sandy storm? Right? All of us need to open our hearts and open, if we have homes that are closer by, right, open our homes, open our hearts, and for sure open our pocketbooks and say, I need to be part of this. It's something that I wouldn't have done without this. Yes, people are suffering way more than us. You know, we write a $100 check or get a little uncomfortable in the amount, a little further push us, you know, a little past where we'd rather feel like. But, I mean, I'm thinking about friends who are, they're homeless, you know, like, I get Facebook because we used to live in Long Beach, Long Island. So I have Facebook posts from friends. No car, infrastructure of house destroyed, family fine. Great. Okay. But they're my age, or some are a little bit older. We were actually the youngest in the group there. So they're in their mid-50s to later 50s, some early 60s, right? That's their retirement, is their house. You know, they bought their house for $200,000 or $150,000 at some point in their lives. Now their house is worth $800,000, a million, because it's in Long Beach, right? Just a regular kind of like Winston Downs type of a house, that level of a neighborhood, right? They're worth $1 million now. I'm not talking a Lowry house, just like a regular middle-class house, but that's their retirement. They can make aliyah on that. You know, that's what so many people are planning, you know, like, or they refinance it to pay for all their kids' tuitions, but whatever. That's how you do it. People say, well, how do you pay, you know, $15,000 times five or six? Well, you really count on your house going up in value, because that's how you do it. Anyway, there's people now, I don't know how it's going to work with debt and no house, or with no retirement. Look, how does that work? I don't know. Anyway, the point is, part of the storm is for what they need. And part of the storm is for what we need, to draw chesed out of us. We, Jews, need to be kind to each other. We need to be kind to each other and kind to others, too, not just Jews. But part of that kind of thing, part of what's going on in Israel, is for us to daven. We can't be there. We don't know what it's like to have to run in 15 seconds into a shelter, or 60 seconds if you're a little bit further away, and do it again and again. Right? I mean, I thought about it. I slept at the hospital. I thought about when I was called, like, as soon as we fell asleep, you know, another crisis. So we went back downstairs to daven. So, but what would it be like if it was missiles, right? As soon as you fall asleep and your kids are asleep, you've got to gather everybody up and run into a shelter, right? And you have a plan for it. Or you sleep in the shelter room, whatever it is. But it's not comfortable sleeping in the shelter room. There's no air in there, you know? Like, so, but what is that like? So we need to be thinking and davening for them. As part of it is connection. How to create that connection. And part of the connection is the more connection we create, the more merit we generate, the more God can protect us that way. And I personally think sometimes some of these things happen because we're low on kindness. We're low on kindness output. And so God says, guys, you're my people. I need you. We have this like response thing going on here, right? And so I will do what you do, but I need you guys to do it. So I'm going to make it a little difficult so that you guys all have to respond with kindness, because I know you will, right? I'll rough you up a little bit so you respond with kindness, and that opens channels of kindness, and then I can send the kind energy down, you know, to protect you, to keep you safe from Iran, to keep you safe from whatever. But first we're going to have to rough up the edges so that the kindness starts to pour out. It would be great if we could do it without that. But sometimes that's what needs to be done. Is that a punishment because we're not kind enough? It could be in some cases, and it could be in order to draw us out further. So is it there? Should we be thinking we need to draw out further, or should we be thinking that God gave it to us in order to draw us out further? It's both. It really is both. So I'll give you another story. So I have a friend who, her third child was stillborn, and then they revived him. Now he has very severe CP, right? Very severe. So at first I was thinking, why did they do that? You know, she's got two kids, and now she's got a kid who's like really severely handicapped. Turns out, they didn't know yet, but turns out he's not mentally handicapped, but his speech is so slurred and his body is so difficult that you can't even really tell that he's not mentally handicapped. And certainly it was much harder for him to learn, but once it got in, it's in, solid and strong. But he didn't walk until he was four. I mean, I don't think he crawled until he was four, so still at four. Like, but she, so the baby comes home, the whole community's, you know, reaching out. This was in Long Beach. And I really, like, just wasn't sure, you know, what was God thinking, you know, and why? Why did God do this? And then I started to see the response in her. Not only did she care for this child, which did end her childbearing. She might have had a couple more if she didn't have that one. But she turned the world upside down in terms of care for CP. She scoured the planet for different types of medications, procedures, therapies, whatever it was, and she brought a whole special Hungarian therapy to America that the American Association of CP hadn't really used and wasn't so into, but really about not teaching the child, not adapting the world to the child, but adapting the child to the world, like teaching the child how to deal with a regular fork, not a special fork, and all these different things. And she really changed not only how CP is dealt with, certainly in that area, but the schooling and inclusion in schooling. And so I really saw how she changed the world, and how she changed others. Then on Simchas Torah, in our shul, we have a whole aliyah for all the children. Everybody gets an aliyah on Simchas Torah. All the men get an aliyah on Simchas Torah. So everybody gets called up one by one, and then all the children as a whole group. And in our Sephardic congregation in Long Beach, we have four taluses sewn together to make a huge chuppah for that aliyah. It's just for that aliyah. So the men hold the four corners, and all the children come up, and he's one of the children. He's four, and he can't walk, and he can't crawl yet. He's on the hip of his mother. In that shul, the mechitza is kind of low. It's about eye height. So you could touch somebody, pass something over to somebody. You can see on the other side very well. So one of the other men, not the child's father, but one of the other men from the congregation came over to the mechitza to receive the child. So mom passes the child over. And as I saw him reach out to receive this child, I thought, look at the love in this congregation and what this child has done. Look how we're such a closer family. Look at the love on this man's face as he reaches for this child. Like, look who we've become as a group because God let this child live. You know, what was I thinking that I know better than God? Why did God let that child live? How mean is that? Look what it did for us. So it is all mixed so hard, and yet it can draw out so much, but only if we let it, right? Because a lot of people will take something really difficult and say, you know, where is God? God's not there, and I'm not there, and I'm not going there, and I'm shutting down, right? People can get angry, they can get bitter, they can get hardened, whatever it is, or they could open, open, and open again, right? And it doesn't mean that God's not going to push you to open again. Right? He might. He said, great, you got to this place. Let's go further. And it's hard. Right? So there's different ways of seeing it. I mean, I have a Hasidish friend who expressed it this way. She said, I feel like I can never catch the bus. I'm always running, always in the dust, always in the exhaust, and I can never catch it. Right? So because there's always something beyond. Whatever you achieve, you got to go further. So she feels that way. I don't see it that way. I feel like I'm constantly opening a present. And you know how you open a present and sometimes there's a present inside, and you open that present, there's a present inside, but it's always smaller, right? Because it has to fit inside the box. You think it's like it's wrapped in a TV box, and in the end it's a pair of earrings, right? But I feel like every time I open the present in Judaism, I tear off the wrapping paper and I see what's inside, it's bigger. Right? And it's more of a mystery, but it's bigger and more exciting. And I tear off the wrapping paper again, and I open it up, and I see what's inside. I'm like, wow, it's even bigger. And it's even bigger. Every time I open it up, it's even bigger. So for me, it's more exciting. But I could see with a different personality type, it could be overwhelming. Like the same thing, that there's always something more. It could be like, what? There's something more? I can't believe it. I'm not finished. Right? So it could be frustrating, or it could be really exciting.
Personality thing you're saying is the difference there. So it's the circumstances that person's been given.
I think it's both.
And training.
Right. So there's temperament for sure. And then there's training. This being part of that. Mm-hmm. And the way you speak to your children really being part of that. So this is perspective shifting, what we're doing right now.
Right.
So that you can then work with your children and say, and with yourself, constantly, and say, here's my chance to grow. How can I grow through this? How can I grow through this? Start with something small.
So is it through example then?
It's through example.
Yes.
Yes, it's example and practice. It is a practice in life. Right, so you have to understand what you're doing, and then you have to start practicing it. Right, like nutrition. You could know it, but if you're still eating chocolate bars for breakfast, right? Yeah, we won't comment on what we eat for breakfast. Yeah.
So, I think the perspective is incredibly important as well. You started by talking about folks that perceive having a special needs child as a punishment.
Right.
Red letter, whatnot. I think, well, I'm going to call that a misperception.
It is a misperception,
but
I think.
But why? I think a lot of folks see the whole reward punishment relationship with God as a misperception. And you hear people say, well, Katrina was because of all the sitting that was going on.
Right. Okay, so let's go there for a minute.
I've heard, the Holocaust was because of all the intermarriage going on in Germany, stuff like that.
Right. Okay, so we know. So first of all, it's wrong to say that. We can't know. We can't know. That being said, we do know that God has chosen, and is not required to, but has chosen to be our shadow. It says in Psalms, I am your shadow. Forgot where it says that, but you could find it. I am your shadow. What does that mean? Shadows do what we do. We initiate, shadows follow. God has chosen to be our shadow. He set up the world so that he follows us. Yes, he sometimes causes events, but he does follow us. That being said, let's look on a broader scale. First of all, we can't know, but we should look. We should look, but we can't draw conclusions. We're forbidden from drawing conclusions because we can't know, but we should look. So let's just look and see. Katrina, breaching of boundaries, right? That's what a flood like that is, boundaries being breached. Then you could say, well, gosh, in New Orleans, a lot of boundaries are breached by human beings. There's a lot of boundary breaching behavior. If God is a shadow, it's possible, and we should look. Certainly as a resident of New Orleans, we should look and say, gosh, how could I participate in strengthening the boundaries of my community in order to hopefully get God to respect boundaries? How could I respect them more so that God respects them more? Right? There, so we should ask questions like that, and we should not say, you're being punished for. If we get a cold sore, we should say, I wonder if I'm speaking not nicely about others. But we should never, ever, ever look at somebody else who has a cold sore and say, they must speak a lot of Lashon Hara. We're totally forbidden from doing that. And in terms of reward and punishment, even if there is, it's never that direct. So we don't have clear things. So somebody who, it's interesting because when the Amzels, I don't know if you remember Rabbi Amzel in this community, Rabbi Yehuda Amzel and his wife Tirza, they unfortunately lost a 2-year-old child. And like this, right? She had like a cold, and the next day she was a little sicker. They took her to the hospital, and she died like 2 hours later. Just like up and died. And they buried her that afternoon. And on her tombstone, they just wrote, she was snatched and buried. That was it. They were told not to say that. What character traits can you talk about somebody who's 2? Right? You can't say she was so cute. Like, you don't want to put that on. So they just said, nikdafa v'nikbara. She was snatched and buried. And because they saw it as a merit that she was able to be buried right away. So now you have this couple who's so sweet and so pure and so giving and so loving, known in the community as a very special couple. And everyone's looking, thinking, what? From them? Why from them? Like, how do you, like, what is that? So his rabbi from Lakewood, who also lost a child, I think a little bit older, flew out for a Shiva call. And it was interesting the way he said it. He said, don't be so gaivadic. Don't be so self-centered and prideful to think that this is a punishment. What a way to say it. I just thought that was so interesting. Like, God doesn't respond in that exact way. You did something wrong, I'm taking your kid. He doesn't do that. That's not what it is. You spoke of the Lashon Hara, you get a sore. Even though we do have in the Chumash, it does discuss Lashon Hara and Lashon Hara related ailments, that there were skin ailments that came from that. We don't have that today. And we don't have that close a connection between the physical and the spiritual. We do have a connection between the physical and the spiritual. So we do have to look, but it's so distant that we cannot draw conclusions. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking. So in ourselves, we should be looking, and we should say, I wonder what I need. How could I grow through this? Is there tshuva that I need to do? Even for me, I thought about some tshuva I need to do from this, right? So who knows what else there is, but certainly just the fact that the junior Erlangers in our community and the... what's their last name? The Berkowitzes both had children in the NICU for a long time. I'm not really friends with them. I didn't really pay attention at all. Now I know what it's like to have a kid in the NICU. Like, it doesn't matter if you're friends or not. Like, it's nice to cook for somebody. It's nice to call them. It's nice to send them a card. It's nice to bake something for the other children in the family or offer to take them out. You know, take them to whatever, the stock show, the toy train show, like, get the kids out so the parents can have a few minutes. Like, I never really understood what it's like, and especially if you have other kids at home, how stressful must it be? Bad enough it's your first kids, but if you have to pay attention, like the roommate in Eli Sheva's room, that it's their third kid. And it's interesting, I heard the two dads talking, I just overheard the two fathers talking about. So the other father told Yoshua, he said, you know, we came in on Veterans Day. I said, I'm a veteran. So, you know, people ask me, like, what's the hardest assignment I ever had? He said, this is for sure it. Putting a kid in the NICU is the hardest thing I've ever done. So, like, I never really thought about what is it. So for sure, I am planning on calling both of those mothers and apologizing for not being there for them. Like, they're just community people, but, like, I should have called. Like, I had no clue what it's like. So whatever level of tshuva there is to be done, there's tshuva for sure. And then there's the growth. So there's all of it together. So we shouldn't draw specific conclusions, and we should still look. So, I still have another few minutes. So let's just review. God knows everything, every thought, every deed, everything that we do, even every pre-thought, and understands us perfectly. It's one thing that's important to know is that while our knowledge is separate from us, we can talk about our knowledge, we can talk about the body of human knowledge as distinct from human beings, even though, if you think about it, the body of human knowledge is only held by human beings. Right? If there wouldn't be human beings, there wouldn't be knowledge, right? But God and knowledge are not distinct. God is knowledge. It's not something that we can understand because we don't have that experience. We have knowledge and self as two distinct things. I know this, right? So I am separate from what I know, but God is not. But that's one reason why we pursue knowledge with the word dat. There's a lot of different words for knowledge that we have in Judaism, but dat is one of them. But that specific word, dat, one of the meanings that it has is total blending with the subject, which is why that word for knowledge is also used for sexual relations. And he knew her, right? So we use that in the Bible. It's not a euphemism. It means, and I think, I'm not positive, I have to check this out, I think that you only use and he knew her with married couples. Because there's also he laid with her, which is different than he knew her, right? So one is having sex and one is making love, right? They're two different things. So that one is coming into, is engaging in a physical relationship that brings the knowledge so close that you're working on blending the two of you into oneness, right? That's part of what it is. So that's dat. And that's one reason why we pursue knowledge as Jews, is the more we can know, the more we can blend with the knower. We create a pathway of blending in knowing. So that is one reason why knowledge is so important to Jews. We want to learn. It's not about just knowing stuff, although there's a group of us that has disconnected from its source, and we see it, then learn in college, you know. You just want doctors and lawyers for children because it's learn, right? But it's not. It's learn, because the more you learn, the more you connect with God. So, and then there's God's response. So that God responds to us makes everything that we do meaningful. If it would be pre-programmed, it would be devoid of meaning. If it's a response to a relationship, it's meaningful. Whatever we do is meaningful. Okay, any questions or any thoughts before we get overrun with all the kids? Sure. Pleasure. Thanks.